Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And on our show today, Christy, we're going to be wrapping up a two-part series on physician aid in dying with Dr. Farr Curlin, professor of medicine and medical humanities at Duke University School of Medicine, about the role of the physician in physician-assisted death, a conversation that one of our colleagues, Dr. Michael Baca Atlas, was able to have in a great interview.
I know. I'm looking forward to that. And we do have research that matters today. We've got great house calls today. We've got a good show, don't we?
We do. But before we get started, I do want to acknowledge that you have stepped up to the plate and take on a new and major role in the University of North Carolina's Department of Family Medicine. You had an honor and you were selected to be an interim chair as our current chair after 17 years stepping down, and just wanted to say congratulations. I couldn't be happier to see someone as talented as you stepping into a leadership role nationally to influence the discipline of family medicine.
Well, thank you so much, Adam. I am delighted to serve in this capacity and to work together with remarkable colleagues such as yourself in family medicine and in the UNC healthcare system at large towards shared vision.
Well, we know all of your health listeners around the world, and you have many, many fans in North Carolina and outside. Wish you well and look forward to hearing about your successes, challenges, and contributions.
Thank you. We will work together. First, we have some research that matters. We'll get right down to it. We're going to talk about children's calories and strategies to reduce those calories.
And they're looking at, can we change the caloric density of children's meals or have lower calorie meals? And what happens if we actually don't do that, the consequences of that, in a study based upon these sorts of foods in children's school lunches?
So this was research that was published in Physiology and Behavior, really looking to see if you serve lunch in different child care centers once a week, and this was targeted at to 120 children ages 3 to 5 years, to see what happens to their weight, what happens when you give them a varied levels of portion size and of caloric density foods.
Yeah, so across these meals that these children received, they could be served meals at three levels of portion size, 100%, 150%, or 200%. That sounds excess calories for certain. And two levels of density of foods, calories. So maybe not a large size, but very dense calories at 100%, 142%. And they found that when served a combination of a larger portion size and a higher density meals, the children, as expected, intake increased by 175 calories in a single meal over the course of a week. That's approaching close to a half a pound, and over the course of a month, that's well over a pound of extra calories there. And few children seem to be able to resist these by just not eating what was in front of them.
Well, considering the problem that we're facing with childhood obesity and adult obesity in our nation, really thinking strategically about how to change those portion sizes and how to alter what we offer our children in terms of the caloric density of foods is really two strategies that can reduce their calorie intake and help prevent. I mean, I think this is part of the puzzle, along with increased physical exercise and a whole variety of things on a policy level. But this is part of the puzzle.
Yeah, I think for parents, a take home from this research is you can give your children the size of the calorie that what they're giving to be smaller, and then how many calories are in that to be less, and they will probably actually get less calories. You have to pay attention to both factors.
Absolutely. Let's talk about medical students. So there has been a lot of attention nationally about burnout, alcoholism, suicide rates, divorce rates, all of these things among physicians in our nation that are very present. This is a study that was just published in Academic Medicine, really targeting medical students. They surveyed 12,500 medical students, a third of whom answered the survey, and looked at alcohol abuse, dependence, and found some concerning things related to burnout.
Yeah, this is one of the most shocking among many shocking research that I think we bring to our listeners, Christy. Close to a third of the group that was responding had experienced, and these are self-reports, clinical alcohol abuse or dependence. And this compares to 16% of those who are kind of the same age not in medical school, and much higher than the rate of what we've seen in kind of surveys of U.S. physicians or the general public, research by Mayo Physicians.
They found that burnout factors like emotional exhaustions or feelings of depersonalization were associated with the alcohol abuse and dependence among these medical students, and that if a student was of younger age than their peers, if they were unmarried, and if they had a high amount of educational debt, which is extremely common, those things really increased their risks associated with alcohol abuse.
And some of these things are amenable to interventions, such as reducing educational debt, making sure that when students come in have good social support. We can't require them to be married or to be older, but that would, you know, but we can do things to increase the social support. And I think have these conversations early on with medical students, get them the resources. This does not mean that the medical students who see our patients are having problems, but it means that we have to talk with them to prevent these things and have these open conversations. We want to prevent any problem from occurring when they graduate, and that we can assure that the likelihood that they're going to suffer alcohol abuse, dependence, and burnout is as low as possible.
Good points. Now, we need to talk again about the use of chronic pain meds, or these medications called opioid medications. These are Percocet, morphine, Vicodin, those types of pain medicines. We know that across our nation, people are dying at alarming rates, if you look at this.
And 40 a day, some estimates, 165,000 a year, which would make it one of the largest preventable causes of death in society.
It is shocking, truly shocking. And so as we're looking at this and trying to address it, the Center for Disease Control came out with a new statement and new guidelines to try to limit chronic use of these types of pain medications.
Yeah, and let me just clarify that the 165,000 was actually over the last decade and a half. So, but that's still a huge number, thousands a year. And these new guidelines really are trying to, as you say, Christy, limit and recommend non-opioid like acetaminophen or ibuprofen, though we do know ibuprofen can be problematic for some folks as well. But it's the preferred therapy for chronic pain unless they have active cancer or receiving end-of-life care.
I mean, we need to do probably multiple shows on this and have an expert on to talk about these issues. And we really will encourage you as our listeners, if you're taking these long-term pain medications, even short-term, do it with great caution. Talk to your doctor about other strategies to treat pain and to improve your quality of life without being on them, if possible.
And recommending short-term release formulations rather than longer lasting formulations because they're less likely to cause the overdose. These are all in the guidelines. We'll get the guidelines put up there. Let's talk about last research that matters quickly. It's about vaccine refusal and the increased risk of certain vaccine-preventable diseases like measles and pertussis.
Yeah, well, it's hard to do this quickly because it's a hot topic for many people. But this is research that's looking at the cases of measles and of pertussis that are attributable to people who do not vaccinate their children. So parents who delay or skip childhood vaccinations, it's those children who are contributing to the outbreaks of measles and pertussis.
And this was reported in the Journal of the American Medical Association, and really looking at half of the 1,400-plus measles cases in the most recent reports to the U.S. since it was declared eliminated actually are in people who have not had the vaccination. And over the 10,000 pertussis cases, a third or so in the five largest statewide epidemics were among unvaccinated or partially vaccinated. So much higher proportions. Vaccination is not the whole story here.
Right.
But and it is part of the story.
It's also important to note that most of the unvaccinated people had non-medical reasons for skipping the vaccinations. So, of course, there's some children and adults for whom being vaccinated is not safe with their other medical problems. But the majority of these cases were people who elected not to have them for other reasons.
So we encourage discussions with your provider about vaccinations and really understand the risk involved of not vaccinating.
That does conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, our colleague Dr. Michael Baca-Atlas will be talking with Dr. Farr Kerlin, professor of medicine and medical humanities at Duke University School of Medicine, about the role of the physician and efficient physician-assisted death. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health. I'm Dr. Michael Baca-Atlas, filling in for Dr. Christy Page and Dr. Adam Goldstein. Today on Conversations, we'll be talking with Dr. Farr Kerlin, professor of medicine and medical humanities at Duke University School of Medicine, about the role of the physician and physician-assisted death. Welcome, Dr. Kerlin, to the show. Thank you so much for being with us today. How are you doing today?
I'm doing fine, thank you.
Thanks for being with us today. This is certainly an interesting topic. And before we delve in and talk about some of the works that you've produced and published, would you be able to explain to our listeners, you know, what exactly physician-assisted death is?
Yes, and I should note at the outset that the language is itself contested. You use the term physician-assisted death. Traditionally, the language was physician-assisted suicide, and often people use the terms physician aid in dying. Physician-assisted suicide is the practice whereby a patient requests that his or her physician provide a prescription for medications that are in a lethal dosage so that the patient can take those medications and take his or her own life at a time of their choosing.
How did you become involved with this particular topic in your career?
Well, I practiced palliative medicine here at Duke University and before at the University of Chicago. So I take care of many people who are dying and people with very advanced illness who face the imminent prospect of death. And I've had patients ask me over the years, not many, but some have asked me whether I would be willing to help them hasten their death if the time came and they asked for it. So this is a topic that's not just of intellectual interest, it's a practical interest.
And that's a segue into the fact that you did write a piece for the Journal of the American Medical Association, which is titled Why Physicians Should Oppose Assisted Suicide. Is this ever justifiable? No. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about why you feel that is never justifiable?
Assisted suicide is not justifiable for physicians in the first instance because the practice contradicts the very purpose of medicine. Medicine is unfortunately come to be practiced in many contexts as if it is just a powerful set of means, technological means, to be used to pursue the goals of whoever has the power to direct those means. And now we are told, and some are arguing, that we should use those means to aim at the patient's death. But for centuries, physicians have maintained a very clear profession, in fact, central to our profession, that we are to act for the good of those who are sick, which is to say, act so as to preserve and restore the health of our patients, and never act in a way that contradicts or undermines that commitment. Killing a patient or helping a patient to kill themselves clearly undermines that commitment.
Now, we have sort of a point counterpoint with another physician about, you know, the other end of this, that this, you know, is justifiable, and that there are several states, I believe, that where this is legal. Have you been involved with, you know, the state of North Carolina and the discussions that have been going on here, if those discussions have been present?
It is not the case in North Carolina, to my knowledge, that there a bill has been proposed that would legalize assisted suicide, nor has there been efforts that have gained any traction to put this on a ballot initiative or any other policy effort. It is, as you say, legal now. Assisted suicide is legal now in several states, with California being the most recent, which California passed this through the legislature late last summer, and then it was signed by Governor Brown. Notwithstanding these, I think, unfortunate developments, this is very bad medicine. And it is going to, insofar as physicians participate in assisted suicide, they're not only going to be directly contradicting the purposes of medicine and the profession that physicians have made for centuries, but I think they're going to erode and undermine the trust that makes it possible for patients who don't want their physicians to help them die or to hasten their death to entrust themselves to physicians when they're so sick they can't care for themselves.
And trust was something that reading over your article was a pretty significant theme. You sort of just mentioned you want to touch a little bit more on how physician-assisted death somehow breaches or maybe even nullifies that trust. And, you know, as you kind of described before, if so, how?
Yeah, you might ask, what is it that a physician, what is it that a patient expects of their physician when they go to see them? Is there any kind of commitment that the physician has made and that the patient can count on other than to follow the wishes of the patient, however those wishes are spelled out? If the only thing that protects the patient from being killed is their capacity to insist that they not be killed, or then when they are sick, and as we often observe, we physicians who take care of patients with advanced illness, they're sick, they're tired, they're struggling with a sense that their life is worthless and meaningless, then they cannot trust in that situation that their physician has solidarity with them because they are sick, because they are weak, because they're dependent. But rather, their solidarity with them is a solidarity only with their will to live. And in such cases, the patient's continued life is something that they have to carry the weight for. They can't count on their physician to be an ally, encouraging, supporting, walking with them, even when they've lost the strength to do that on their own. And I should say that trust is crucial also because it's only a very small minority of people that want to kill themselves, even among those with advanced illness. And those who have availed themselves of assisted suicide have been disproportionately wealthy, educated, and white. And it turns out that the trust of communities that are less wealthy, educated, and white on average, there's evidence that there's more distrust of physicians caring for people at the end of life in those communities, minority communities, poorer communities, immigrant communities. In such communities, if they know that physicians are considering it as one of their options to intentionally hasten the patient's death or even put the question to the patient whether they might not want to take their own life, then I think you've put clearly another obstacle in the way of those patients being able to receive the palliative medicine and the proportionate wise medicine that they need when they're very sick.
Thank you, Dr. Krillin. We are going to take a short break. When we return, we'll be continuing to talk with our guest, Dr. Farr Krillin, professor of medicine and medical humanities at Duke University School of Medicine, about the role of the physician and physician-assisted death.
Your health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Michael Baca-Atlas, filling in for Dr. Christy Page and Dr. Adam Goldstein. We've been talking with Dr. Farr Krillin, professor of medicine and medical humanities at Duke University School of Medicine, about the role of the physician and physician-assisted death. So, Dr. Krillin, we just, before we went to a break, we were discussing essentially the patient's ability to trust their physician and how this is it was something important that you had been discussing. And I know that we wanted to clarify just a little bit further some additional points regarding that.
Yeah, I wanted to say if you look at the data from Oregon, people avail themselves of assisted suicide not because they have pain that's refractory and cannot be treated, not because they're breathless or because they have other symptoms that good palliative medicine treats. In fact, 91.5% of the people who committed assisted suicide reported their primary concern being one of losing autonomy. And then just a slightly smaller proportion were worried about being less able to engage in activities making life enjoyable, and loss of dignity and loss of control of bodily functions. What emerges as a clear pattern is that assisted suicide is driven by a sense that to be grossly debilitated and dependent and to be reduced in one's capacities is to face a state of life that's not worth living. And yet it's exactly that kind of dependence and need and weakness that should elicit from physicians the most solidarity. It's just those people toward whom physicians have the highest obligation. Just insofar as someone is sick and in need, then the physician has an obligation to care for them. So assisted suicide turns this constitutive orienting commitment of physicians on its head by suggesting that when someone has that kind of need or debility, then the physician is to flip her orientation from solidarity and care and walking alongside those who are weak and debilitated and sick, and instead agree with them, at least in their action, that their life, because they're so debilitated, has become a life not worth living. That, to me, seems a really fundamentally contradictory action for a physician, and one that will corrode what remains of the trust in the profession.
And just for our listeners that are tuning in, you've spoken about palliative care. We haven't necessarily touched upon just briefly hospice, but in about maybe 20 or 30 seconds, I think there's a lot of confusion out there with these two concepts. And I see this and experience this in the hospital myself about trying to clarify these terms for our listeners right now.
Palliative medicine is that discipline of medicine which is specialized in and focuses on the relief of very difficult symptoms. Pain is the most prominent and recognized, but we treat many other symptoms, including breathlessness, nausea, constipation, itching, and an array of other difficult symptoms. Hospice is a structure in which medical care can be organized for those who have a short prognosis, for those who have a terminal illness and have less than 6 months on average to live. And if someone's in hospice, then they forego the usual track of going to the hospital and seeing specialists and having life-sustaining treatment, and instead get more basic and conservative care, usually delivered in the home, and oriented primarily to them being able to preserve as much function and health and the relief of symptoms as possible.
Thank you for clearing that for our listeners. So your argument ultimately leads back to the Hippocratic Oath, you know, an oath that all physicians make, and that intentionally killing a patient, whether they ask for it or not, is a breaking of that oath. But hasn't the Hippocratic Oath been changed in the past to reflect the changing role of physicians? Could it not be changed again to accommodate physician-assisted death, or is that bridge just simply too far?
Yeah, no, the oath could be changed, but we have to ask, is the Hippocratic Oath a notable oath because it's Hippocratic, or is it notable because it reflects what we can all still recognize as good reason regarding the practice of medicine? I think it's clearly the latter. Physicians have taken the oath and different versions of the oath through the centuries, not because there's something magical about being Hippocratic, but because the oath expresses these enduring central aspects of the profession of medicine. So we can change the oath, and in fact, people have changed the oath. But when one changes the oath to allow for killing one's patients rather than keeping the oath's commitment to never give a deadly remedy to a patient, no matter how much implored, we're not showing progress. We're showing regress. We're showing corruption and decline, not enlightenment.
And, you know, as you've stated before, that, you know, this is, you know, not in the realm of what physicians should be performing, you know, in their clinical practice. Is there a role for another type of provider to provide this service, or, you know, another third party, or should it stop, you know, with, you know, all providers, you know, no matter what specialty or practice or degree of training?
Yeah, I think it's a fundamental obligation of the state, of a properly oriented just authority, is to defend its members who are innocent from being killed. And that's traditionally in the West been extended to include a proscription against suicide. So I think the state has good reasons to make suicide illegal, even if it's not going to criminalize it. But whether or not you agree with that, it seems really clear that if there are people who are going to help others commit suicide, those people shouldn't be physicians. And I have to say, one of the things that's really telling to me about this debate is, why are physicians being sought out as the ones to kill patients? There are many ways that are more efficient and more reliable for killing someone than giving them a dose of barbiturates or other medications that are suppressed respiration. I think the fact that the physicians are called into this reflects a understandable human desire to associate the moral traditional prestige of a caring profession with an act that is not congruent with that profession. And if there's going to be legalized killing, it certainly should not be physicians that are doing it.
And that sort of goes in line with what you discussed in your arguments, sort of the difference between a physician and a service provider. What, in your view, is the role of the physician? You've sort of touched on this briefly, but where does that differ from a provider of services?
Yeah, interesting. If you go all the way back to Aristotle in his famous book on ethics, he says, look, let's start with what's clear. Different practices have different purposes. For example, the purpose of shipbuilding is a ship, and the purpose of medicine is health. So that was obvious, and it's been obvious for centuries that what makes a physician is a commitment and a discipline and an orientation toward the patient's health. It doesn't mean we treat health as the only thing in life, or that we pursue it without regard to anything else in life, or that we try to keep people alive as long as possible, no matter what. It does mean, however, that the goal that physicians seek, the end which gives orientation and direction and meaning to our profession and distinguishes it from other practices, is that we seek to preserve and restore the measure of the patient's health that could be preserved and restored. And we do that in light of and with respect for the patient's pursuit of other goods in their life, so that if the patient says, I'm not interested in my health, well, then we're willing to step back. But what we're not willing to do as physicians is take some other goal, like the patient's death, that contradicts the very purpose of our practice.
Dr. Curlin, thank you so much for being with us today and discussing with us the topic of physician-assisted suicide and also discussing some of your work that's been published on the subject. We've been talking with Dr. Farr Curlin, professor of medicine and medical humanities at Duke University School of Medicine, about the role of the physician and physician-assisted death.
Thank you.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Christy, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about our listeners' health questions and concerns.
If you have a question you'd like for us to address on an upcoming show, please send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu, and we'll have our executive producer, Daniel Lane, read us our very first House Call of the day. Daniel?
I'm a 47-year-old healthy male who has started experiencing tremendous anxiety and other health problems. A long workup hasn't shown anything, and my doctor says it's probably anxiety. I'm anxious about the symptoms, but I can't think of anything else that I'm anxious about. What should I do?
That is a really tricky question, and it unfortunately it's one that's common. I have many patients who suffer from anxiety and maybe can't identify a very specific trigger or a very specific thing that they're worried about. I would say if you're uncertain of the diagnosis, it sounds like what you said was a long workup. It's hard to know what all that was, but it sounds like you have a doctor who's willing to partner with you and see you back, do an evaluation, and is having this conversation with you. There are sometimes with patients where it comes a place where you say, well, I'm not sure, but maybe it's worth treatment for anxiety and to see, maybe it makes a difference. Some cognitive behavioral therapy, as we talk about often on the show, Adam, sometimes medications or both. And if you have anxiety, it may really improve your symptoms and therefore quality of life.
I couldn't agree more, Christy. I mean, we have so many patients who are depressed but say there's nothing really happening in their life
right. That's
depressing. And we know biology plays a role here in that just like you can become hypothyroid, a low thyroid because of biology, not something that you've done or happened to you. It just happens. The same thing happens with depression, and the same thing can happen with anxiety. So sometimes treatment here can make you better, and you may or may not uncover other factors going on. The real question is, with the good treatment, which might include the behavioral therapy, but also medication, just as you say, Christy, you might get better.
Right. And it's worth a try. Like, it's not necessarily that you have to do it forever. You could try it and see how it goes. So it may be, and many of my patients in this type of situation tell me later, I wish I hadn't waited so long. Like, I'm so glad that I got the treatment because I feel so much better.
And those symptoms that are making you anxious, if those go away, you will be less anxious.
Right.
That's a good thing.
Right. Okay.
Thanks for that question. Mm-hmm. What's our very next house call, Daniel?
I have a callus underneath my toe. The toe next to it pushes on it underneath, and I've tried putting cotton between my toes but haven't gotten any relief. What's the next step?
I wish you could send us a picture of your toe. Sometimes people will have a toe deformity in a way that it's rubbing, that the toes are rubbing on each other, and that's causing the callus. Or sometimes the callus is pushing it in a way that then is making it rub on the other toe, but it is complicated.
Yeah, we call sometimes this a structural orthopedic problem here. Otherwise, it's pushing on each other. and so things just kind of move as they get older. And that one toe's either moving under the other or the other toe's moving on top of it. And unfortunately, there's not a lot that can be done non-intervention. You might be able to get some special shoes made that could do this. That's a possibility. You might have to work with wherever you may be located to see if there is a physical therapist who perhaps specializes in orthotics, and that might help. You probably also might need to see an orthopedic surgeon who specializes in the feet or a podiatrist who specializes in the feet to take a look, because this actually might need some surgical correction to really prevent it. It's a difficult situation.
It is. And sometimes that person or your primary doctor can guide you towards, you know, you've tried the cotton, but sometimes there are other things to relieve the pressure that you can put in that can maybe buy you a little more time if you don't want to proceed with surgery. But it's really worth exploring all those options. Often it does require if you really want it to be improved, it may require some sort of surgical intervention. Thank you for your question. We hope your feet are feeling better. What's your next house call question, Daniel?
My mother was recently in the emergency room with a bad urinary tract infection. The doctors said she seemed confused and were worried about dementia, but it seems to me like it was probably just the infection. What do you think?
I think it's a good question. Mm-hmm. I like the question, and my first gut instinct is to trust you on this one here. But it raises some questions, like, you know, was she confused a month ago, 3 months ago? Because when people get urinary tract infections, particularly as they get older, confusion is a common presenting issue.
Right. Dementia is usually something that's more long going, sort of slowly and more gradually in onset. And something called delirium, which is confusion and more transitory, is very, very common in the elderly with urinary tract infections or when hospitalized in a change of scenery and when they're sick. So it's likely that you are right, that infection just made her more confused and that it's not necessarily that longer-term dementia, but it's hard to tease that out, and I would encourage you to make sure she gets good treatment and then that you have a plan to follow that confusion and make sure that she's getting back to as close as she can be to where she was before.
You know, sometimes the emergency room doesn't know the patients, and we as primary care doctors have known the patients a long time. I remember a year or two ago, Christy had a patient who the emergency room called me that they had admitted to the hospital, and the team in the hospital said, how long has he been really declining in mental health? And I said, he doesn't have declines in mental health. He's actually sharp, really, really sharp. And it's like, oh my goodness, there's been a major change. So people assume sometimes they see someone confused that may have been there a long time. The nice thing is this ultimately led to a diagnosis of seizures that he was actually still experiencing. And when those were treated, and over several weeks to months, his ability to think came completely back to what the baseline. So you got to know what the baseline is. Great, mm-hmm. great points.
Okay. Let's take our last house call question, Daniel.
I'm 50 years old, and I work in housekeeping in a hospital. I recently started coughing whenever I get to work, and the doctor said it could be due to chemical exposure, but the tests and x-rays were all normal. Should I see a pulmonary expert?
Well, that is also, we're going to get some good questions today, Adam. That is also very difficult to tease out. If you don't already have any asthma and if you don't have wheezing and maybe you had something called a pulmonary function test to try to sort that out, if that was one of your tests and that was normal, then it's really hard to prove or hard to sort out, is the coughing coming from something you're exposed to at work? And then what is that thing? There are allergists and immunologists who can help you tease that out. There are also lung specialists who can help you think about that. So seeing a pulmonologist might be the right thing to do. What do you think, Adam?
There's also occupational medicine physicians who specialize mm-hmm. in occupational medicine. Because here, you know, there are lots of chemicals and bleach and solvents at work and housekeeping that you're exposed to. And so it doesn't take a long stretch of the imagination to say you're worse when you're at work, you're better when you're not at work, that this may be work-related. The question is how to prove it. What's the workup? Are you going to need to be on long-term disability or a different work environment? These are really complicated questions that go beyond the medical framework that a lot of primary care docs, sounds like your doctor's done a good starting workup. I would at this point in time recommend you get referred to someone who can really complete this workup, because it's not going to be straightforward.
I very much agree. We wish you all the best as you're working through that. Thank you for your house call questions today, and thanks to everyone for joining us today for Your Health. We hope we've addressed some issues and concerns that are important to your health, and we want you to share your questions and stories by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Visit us online at yourhealthradio.org and follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes to get our health app.
And we'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Farr Kurlan, and our special interviewer today, Dr. Michael Baca-Atlas. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
We'll look forward to talking with you again next week.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.